someone, maybe me.
You are back listening to Radio Autonomia on Berkeley Liberation Radio 104.1, and we are going to start our second part of the show, which is looking at the recent tide of electoral politics with the elections coming right around the corner on November 6th. We figured it best be in our interest and the interest of our listeners to complicate the role that electoral politics play, not only in our everyday lives, but specifically in our organizing, with the debates that just happened this week and the consistent ongoing campaigning that's been happening on TV and various medias. Sometimes we get a little bit wrapped up into possibly believing that participatory democracy or representative democracy is an avenue that actually has effects that benefit a large populace of people. So here at Radio Autonomia, we wanted to complicate this just a little bit. So we have a couple things planned for this part of the show. First, we're going to just ask a simple few questions that I think help us in our organizing and our own way of thinking about elections to complicate our analysis of them. And then we're going to listen to a couple audios from a friend and comrade of ours down in Mexico, Oaxaca, Mexico, Gustavo Esteva. And then we will take a look at the Zapatistas and see how we are inspired by one of their declarations to think beyond party politics. And then we're going to go into a couple local happenings, specifically here in Oakland and then also in Arizona, that are direct evidence that the electoral politics and the institutions of city councils actually fail to represent the needs of people. So a couple questions that we had, or a couple statements, go as follows. Often it is stated that your voice is your vote, which is your right. Your one way of participating in the system of representative democracy. Is it possible for one or two or five people to represent everyone's desires or dreams? And then more specifically, what are the effects of giving certain individuals power to represent or make decisions? Is the process and system of electoral politics set up to acknowledge and represent our needs, dreams, and desires, and implement decisions and changes that make them a reality? Can our one vote compete with the financial contributions, agendas, and desires of corporations and super PACs, specifically after the 2010 hearing of Citizens United? What effect does electoral politics have on the imagination of people to think of new ways to relate to each other and generate ideas about addressing and fixing problems that currently exist? We begin to answer these questions by hearing a brief talk given early this year by Mexican actionist Gustavo Esteva. In this talk, Esteva speaks to the contradictions of current representative democracy systems, which is based on the assumptions that people cannot govern themselves.
All these things force us to revisit democracy. And for that purpose, we need to revisit also the question of power. Power is usually perceived as something that some people have and some others don't have. You have the powerful, those that have power, that thing, and the powerless, that people that don't have any power. And that is why you talk about empowerment. Then you have you can organize the distribution of that thing called power. What is really power? And what is the notion of power that has been dominant and dominating us? One way of saying this, it is using the formulation of Hegel in 1820, when he said people cannot govern themselves. And then someone needs to govern them. Then all the political discussion for 200 years has been how we'll define who will govern the people, how we'll put the power in the hands of these people that will govern the people, because the people cannot govern themselves. We can have elections, we can have a revolution, but basically the problem is how we can define how the people will be governed. I have been used for several years the very famous story of the Wizard of Oz to challenge this view. Do you remember, in your case, the Wizard of Oz? And you remember that it was Dorothea and her friends going to visit the powerful, very powerful Wizard of Oz. And they cross it, and you have all the paraphernalia of power, the noise and sound, and then the little dog of the courting, and then you have a short panic. They don't know. He doesn't know what to do. And then the important point is the discussion afterwards. Then he asks them, why are you coming to see me? What is the reason for this? And then the lion says, oh, you know, I am a coward. I am coming for you to give me courage. What? You have been a very good ideas, lion. You have been protecting your friends all the time. What is happening here? And then it is the thin man that asks, you know, I need a heart. I don't have a heart. I forgot to give me a heart. But why? You have been a very compassionate guy. You are full of emotions and love. Why are you asking for that? And then scarce crowd and say, oh, you need a brain, but you have been the smart guy of the group. You have been leading the whole gang to come here. Why you are asking for that? And this is the parable. It is the people all the time asking to the politicians, to the powers that be, what they already have. But of course, the politicians don't answer like the Wizard of Oz. They say, okay, I will give you everything you want. Just vote for me, and then you will have it all. This is more or less an image, just an image of the idea of power. This notion that power is upstairs, that some people have it, and then they can use it for us, for our benefit, or to intimidate us. What I want to discuss tonight, basically, it is that there is another notion of power that is increasingly popular these days. This is the notion of power that implies that the people hold the power, and that they don't need to ask for anything to anyone.
That was our friend and comrade down in Oaxaca, actually speaking here this year in the U.S., specifically around the inability of governors, of presidents, of various electorates, if you will, to actually represent the mass differences of people's desires, dreams, and needs. He also mentioned at the beginning, sorry about the technical difficulties, but he mentioned at the beginning how we need to begin to trust ourselves to be able to govern ourselves. And there's been this since the early 1800s, this idea that people need a government to govern themselves and you have to elect that government. So there's been a lot of arguments and disparities around who actually has power to govern the populaces of people. And he proposes a pretty, I think, significant proposal that we do have the knowledge, the inspiration, and the practice to learn how to govern ourselves and determine our realities. So with that, we're going to turn back to 1996, and we're going to be hearing from the Zapatistas again, in which they propose in their fourth declaration a new type of political force. And it goes as follows. We invite national civic society, those without a party, the citizen and social movement, all Mexicans to construct this new political force. A new political force which will be national, a new political force based in the EZLN.
A new political force which forms part of a broad opposition movement, the National Liberation Movement, as a space for citizen political action where there may be a confluence with other political forces of the independent opposition, a space where popular wills may encounter and coordinate united actions with one another.
A political force whose members do not exert nor aspire to hold elective positions or government offices in any of its levels. A political force which does not aspire to take power. A force which is not a political party.
A political force which can organize the demands and proposals of those citizens and is willing to give direction through obedience. A political force which can organize a solution to the collective problems without the intervention of political parties and of the government. We do not need permission in order to be free. The role of the government is the prerogative of society, and it is its right to exert that function.
A political force which struggles against the concentration of wealth in the hands of the few and against the centralization of power. A political force whose members do not have any other privilege than the satisfaction of having fulfilled its commitment.
A political force with local, state, and regional organizations which grows from the base, which is its social force. A political force given birth by the civic committees of dialogue.
A political force which is called a front because it incorporates organizational efforts which are nonpartisan and has many levels of participation and many forms of struggle.
A political force called Zapatista because it is born with hope in the indigenous heart which together with the EZLN descended again from the Mexican mountains.
A political force with a program of struggle with 13 points. Those contained in the first declaration of the Lacandon Jungle and added throughout the past 2 years of insurgency. A political force which struggles against the state party system. A political force which struggles for a new constituency and a new constitution. A political force which does not struggle to take political power, but for a democracy where those who govern, govern by obeying. And to break this down, we're actually going to go back to Gustavo Esteban. And in this next section, he talks about his response in 96 to the Fourth Declaration and also the organizing that happened in response to this in Mexico.
The Zapatistas launched the Fourth Declaration of Selva Lacandona on January 1st, 1996. Just a simple invitation. They told us in Mexico, you can create locally small little committees for the dialogue, and you can begin reflecting what is what you can do without the government and without the political parties. What kind of activities, how you can organize your lives without the government and without the political parties. After a few months, I was part of some of these committees. After a few months, we had a joke going around in these committees. There is one thing that someone in Mexico City needs to do that we cannot do locally. It is the designation of Mexican ambassadors in other countries. And the joke was because all the other things we can do locally. We can organize our lives and we can live our lives and do everything without the central structure in Mexico City. And that was a very important element for our imagination to imagine our life and to begin a different kind of construction of our own life in the current conditions. Given the current mobilization all over the world, there are now different struggles for democracy. Some people are still trying to improve formal democracy, representative democracy, the electoral procedures. You know these stories about Ohio and Florida and these kind of things. They are trying to improve the things to prevent the problems of elections to happen again. They try to improve checks and balances and the representation itself. Once we know that the 99% is not represented in the powers that be. This is a novelty in the US, this conviction. For us in Mexico, we always knew that those in power, they were not representing us. We had all the time that distance. We were lacking that fundamental in democratic institution. A democracy can operate only when the people, the majority of the people, believe that they upstairs are really representing them. If the people don't believe that, if they don't have this fundamental belief, then the democratic system cannot operate, cannot function. Some other people are trying to improve the conditions of what they call participatory democracy. It is a little more involvement on the people in the activities of the government, like participatory voting, budgeting and referendum and plebiscitum and these kind of things. But an important trend that perhaps is defining the attitude of the majority is a struggle for radical democracy. Disenchanted with formal democracy, people want real democracy. In Madrid, they are saying, my dreams don't fit into your ballot box. We want real democracy. We want something else. Instead of the system of representation, they attempt to reorganize the society from the bottom up to create something else. They see formal democracy as a good political umbrella for the transition. They see participatory democracy as a good training for those individualized and used to formal democracy. It's a good preparation for radical democracy. But they are really looking for something else.
All right, again, welcome back to Radio Autonomia on Berkeley Liberation Radio. And if you're just tuning in, that was our comrade and actionist, Gustavo Esteva, who does a lot of different work in thinking down in Oaxaca, Mexico. And what he just broke down was a proposal for a radical democracy rather than a representative democracy. And in short, I think a radical democracy is, of course, anti-state and anti-dependent on the electoral campaigns, if you will, but actually touches base on the dignity and the word of the people around us. So it begs the question of what can we do without the government, and how do we think for ourselves and determine our own realities and not depend on someone else to represent us. I think just to reiterate the point that he ended with in Spain, earlier this year, one of the sayings was that our dreams don't fit in your ballot box. And I think that's super pertinent, specifically around the electoral season here in the U.S., in the sense of how many times do we compromise our dreams because of this unquestioned trust in someone we may not even talk to or may not have access to. So with that, we're going to talk a little bit later in this part of the show about examples that we've seen that are working outside of the electoral politics or outside of party politics. But for now, we're going to jump into a song by Crass off the album Yes Sir I Will, and here it is.
Radio Autonomia on Berkeley Liberation Radio 104.1 FM, and we are still talking about challenging electoral politics. And this next piece, we give you evidence of why here in the U.S. and here locally in Oakland, even at a smaller scale, our local representatives are unable to represent the voice of different people, especially voices that are not upholding the status quo. So we're going to start with evidence or a case in Arizona. We know that the SB 1070 bill was passed recently in Arizona. This is the Show Me Your Papers bill, which allows the racial profiling of black and brown people by cops. Right after that, another bill, HB 2281, passed, and this further supports the colonization of brown and people and people of color by removing and making illegal ethnic studies and making Mexican American classes in the public high schools there. Communities made up of youth and students, teachers, parents, and adult allies have been coming out in mass and supporting ethnic studies in Tucson at the Tucson Unified School District board meetings. There have been two meetings with proposed votes that if they had happened, would have brought an end to the current Mexican-American studies, but luckily people there have resisted. The events from those meetings are documented in a short documentary called Fight Back by J.M. Aragon. You can find it on YouTube. And we're about to play a clip from those acts of resistance. The clip we're going to show is the latter half of the documentary, but earlier in the clip, something that you'd be able to see or hear is that there are students that are chaining themselves to the seats of the school board meeting members. So they sort of fill up the school board meeting room and then chain themselves down. So they had to cancel the meeting and therefore the vote against their ethnic study classes never happen. And this is young people, high school students, taking these actions. The students' actions led to the canceling of the meeting, but 1 week later there was another meeting proposed. That was on May 3rd of this year. The community returned. However, school board is now not just your good old school board building, but it is fully loaded with dozens of cops. And before the people could walk into the school board meeting room, cops were frisking everybody that was coming in and having them go through metal detectors. You even see images of young kindergarten students having to having to go through the metal detectors. You also see cops. This is the clip you're about to hear. In that clip, cops are putting up metal gates or barricading so that the crowd that's outside who can't go into the meeting stays outside. And here is the clip from that day.
It just seemed like they were kind of armed to the hilt for this particular meeting.
For the first, hour of the board meeting, we were outside listening to the speakers to hear what was going on in the meeting.
I have been through many superintendents, many administrators, and many boards. And you will be gone, and we will be here.
At one point, though, the speakers went dead and we couldn't hear what was happening. We knew that good friends were inside also speaking, and we heard that some of them were getting arrested.
For extra time because like they gave us I think it was only about seven people got to speak. They refused. Then a doctor, Anne, I think was her name, she asked for more time. They took her away, and then after her, then Lupe Castillo, she went up there to speak, and then about 20 military police surrounded her.
I was going to read excerpts from the letter of Dr. King when he was held in Birmingham jail. And I felt it was important for the board of directors and the superintendent to hear the voice of what needs to be done when there are violations of the rights of a community.
There were about, I say, like 20 cops that came from behind the human chain. One of the officers was stepping on my foot, and I couldn't get up at all.
I was stumbling backwards, and as I was stumbling backwards, he like punched me in the face.
This cop, he grabbed me from my hair from behind, and I didn't even see him. And he pulled me towards him, and then he threw me in the middle of the crowd.
We prevented the killing of our classes for tonight.
So those are voices from Arizona and from young people and their families from the Tucson Unified School District, where, again, this is an example of a group of people, and it's not a small group of people, because if you look at data from Arizona, the highest growing population there is Latinos, and Mexican Americans in Arizona have always been a large number, because they were there before this was even the United States. And they asked for these classes. They created these classes. They still want these classes. But even at a school board level, nobody is listening to those demands or pushing to support the people who benefit from having an ethnic studies program at a high school level. We don't have to go all the way to Arizona to see that representative democracy is a farce. Here locally, just in the past 2 weeks, we've seen the Oakland City Council kick out concerned family and community members of high school student Alan Buford, who was murdered by Oakland PD earlier this year. In the clip that we're going to play for you, you'll hear concerned community speaking and demanding transparency from the council, and then you're going to hear also the council's reaction.
So we appreciate the fact that you're stepping forward and providing us with some information to help us get closer to a better understanding. I mean, but however, we still feel that there is a need, an urgent need. There are kids who are impacted by what happened to Alan. And the kids in their community have this a negative view of how they look at Oakland Police Department's force. And to think that when Alan was murdered, the Oakland Police Department opened its doors to allow individuals to come and walk through. We want individuals to come out and meet with us, to talk with us about ways of changing protocols to ensure that things of this nature are not impacting our youth moving forward. Our youth are severely impacted by what's going on, not only in this meeting, but the lack of what I see as leadership to call for the individual who made this, you know, this atrocious act on our families, one of our family members. So I think that in several ways, answers need to come not 2 months from now. I mean, we need to be able to have an idea of what actually happened. To say 5 months from now, a mother and father does not have an idea of the circumstances that were behind the death of their child, I think is something that not only harms the community, it harms the relationships that are trying to be bridged between the community and the leadership. So finding a way to come together, not for one individual to step up and say, hey, this is what we want to do. We feel the need to sit down with all individuals to collectively come up with a solution, and also understanding that we collectively stand with the individuals who are behind us, who are supporting us. For over 5 months, they've been here with us, helping us along the way to stay united and to stay on a united front, moving forward towards finding a bridge. I mean, we're not sitting here to try to point fingers about who's not doing their job. We want change, and we want change now. And to think that even after Alan's death, there were other murders by police officers, and in many ways, nothing's been happening. We have no idea what's going on with Officer Masso. If I were to go out and murder someone, immediately there will be some consequences. And however, the family feel at this particular point in time, there have been no appropriate actions taken upon the individual who pulled the trigger. I mean, he shot himself and he shot three times a youth who's on his way towards a high school graduation, who no longer has an opportunity to move forward in his life. And I think, but not only that, but to think about the lives of the children who are surrounding this kid and how they look at the Oakland Police Department's force moving forward is a critical issue that needs to be addressed immediately, not to bring a piece of paper and say, oh, okay, here you have it. Yes, okay, I greatly appreciate that, but how do we make change and how do we bring forth understanding for the family? But to have 5 months to not know how your child was killed and murdered, and 5 months, I mean, how much time do we need? And we're asking, and there's been some words being sent by the city administrator about how if more time will be requested, that they'll grant more time. And that's something that I think does not or cannot happen moving forward. 5 months is more than enough time to come up with an idea of what's going on in this investigation, right? And we demand answers now.
Thank you. All right, Madam City Clerk, can we go on to the next meeting?
Next item.
No. No.
They just asked Larry, I'm only going to take a minute. One of the things, and we talked about protocol.
1 minute.
Right. Can we get,
Mr. President,
the general orders of the Oakland Police Department? Can you provide a copy of the general orders of the Oakland Police Department? Can you answer that, please? Can you provide that?
We cannot answer questions. This is open forum.
Okay, listen. Can you tell us where to get it from? I've been trying to find the general orders of the Oakland Police Department. Where can I get it? Copy. Where can I get a copy? All we want is a copy of the protocol that is required by the Oakland Police Department. You can't tell us. I've been online. I've been searching. I've been asking. Can you provide the family with the protocol?
All right.
Can we have the city administrator explain?
In addition to cutting down of their speaking time, the city council this month imposed new rules that cut almost half the seats in the city council chamber. According to the SF Gate, under the new rules, people who do not get one of the 116 available seats can sit in an overflow room two floors below, where the proceedings are shown live on a video feed. Despite the new rules, the Bluford family and their supporters came out en masse Tuesday, as they had done September 18th. Bluford's relatives asked for the police incident report on the shooting, something the police department had refused to turn over. What mother wouldn't want to know what happened to their baby, said Geraldine Bluford, the dead man's mother. The next clip we're going to hear is another evidence of the lack of transparency in Oakland City Council when they decide to just dismiss everybody who was speaking out against the lack of transparency in the Alan Buford case.
Mr. President.
Yes.
I have a motion on the floor that we should request that people be quiet and take their seats, and if they do not, they shall be removed.
I second the motion.
It's been moved and second. Ignacio, Rebecca, you heard the motion that Ms. Schaff put on the floor?
Absolutely.
Favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Motion passed. So I'm going to ask all of you to take your seat, and if you choose not to take your seat, these chambers will be cleared.
Just to specify, the motion was that the people who are standing or yelling would be removed.
Anyone who does not take their seats, who continue to remain standing, we will ask you to leave. Going once, going twice, going three times. Officer, Captain Downey. Can you remove those folks who are still standing and refuse to take their seats?
So even at a local level, with local politicians who we see on our streets and have access to, representation does not happen for those who oppose the status quo. Those with the political power to investigate and change injustice in our community decide not to do so due to a greater power that is not with the people, but instead with the militarized police. In Oakland, we have clear examples of how a representative democracy isn't working just at even a local level, where there's these people who represent our small districts and aren't able to get information from us, from police who we don't have access to, and from other levels of government. One thing that was really nice with Occupy Oakland is that it allowed people here in Oakland to imagine another way of making decisions as a group of people, like making decisions around how food was going to be distributed, around how safety was going to happen in the middle of the night, how different programs such as education programs and medical programs were going to be implemented within the Oakland commune. Something that a lot of young people don't imagine as possible, and a lot of older people forgot that was it was possible to do, which was to govern ourselves. One thing I enjoyed about the assemblies, even though they at times seem chaotic because there's a lot of yelling so that everybody can hear, was that everybody's voice does count, and everybody has a chance to speak, and people aren't getting kicked out or bullied with police if you oppose an idea or anything like that. But people try to figure out what to do with opposing ideas. So we just wanted to end the show talking about other places we've seen people implement alternatives to electoral politics. We've seen it with the Zapatistas and their Juntas de Buen Gobierno, which are the small governments that you find in Zapatista communities. And DJ Profe is going to talk a little bit about the folks there and their organizing there in non-electoral politics.
Yeah, so from my understanding down in Chiapas is there's a notion of governing by obeying, and that governing by obeying is only understood if you actually give everyone a chance to govern. So with the juntas, depending on where folks are at, the actual governing body will rotate. So everyone in a specific community, and now this is much smaller, so that's definitely part of the discussion in the sense of scale and ability to govern with larger or smaller communities. But everyone will actually get to the experience of being in the government, and the emphasis there is to actually lead by the needs of the people. So in that respect, no one can actually take power for an extended period of time, and that allows learning to take place, so you know what it is to be governed, but it's also you know what it is to be governing. So, and I think that is a radical paradigm shift than what we see here in the States, where we give trust, we give our vote, we give our pretty much desires, needs, wants, etc., and we trust in someone to govern us, and in only one platform. So in that sense, Gustavo Esteva mentioned this before, in the sense that we have to create spaces of how to reimagine or to reestablish our imagination of how we can function, how we can relate to each other, how we can create social relations that actually respect our dignity, our desires, and our needs. DJ Nate here also has some experience in Bolivia, and he's going to talk briefly about that.
Thanks. I have just a couple of things to say. I didn't actually grow up here on the West Coast. I grew up in the Midwest. And one of the things that I often heard growing up and in different spaces, in education, in the workplace, in a lot of places, was whenever I was told, this ain't no democracy. And that kind of gives you an idea of the way that people think about democracy in terms of it being equated with a kind of proceduralism, which is equated with electoral politics. And there's a real problem when we conflate democracy with electoral politics and the kind of proceduralism that goes on with it, as we heard in the town hall meeting, where people were not following procedures, so they were, asked to leave and were not able to participate. But if democracy is not equated with electoral politics, so what are the other options? And DJ Profe mentioned one of those with the Zapatistas, and I have some experience in Bolivia, where there are similar political forms of political organizing which are not the same as state kind of electoral politics. One of those comes from the large Aymara population in Bolivia, and that form of organization is the AYU, which is typically a rural kind of organization with rotating leadership, typically 1 year. And there are both men and women on who are the kind of like really kind of like the point people for the issues that are happening in their particular communities. And typically IUs are made up of a number of different families in a particular region, and they might even be consolidated further into a set of IUs. But all of the decisions that happen there happen through kind of consensus process, which takes a long time and is really messy. But there are alternatives. One of the problems for us in thinking and kind of extending or thinking with these other kinds of organization has to do with a real serious difference between rural, urban populations and how to organize, particularly urban populations where lots of people are very mobile and don't stay put very long, and these kinds of things. So I just wanted to mention one other example of where there are other notions of democracy which don't have to do with electoral politics and don't have to do with representing a population or some other designated group. It's not about finding spokespersons or choosing a spokesperson who may or may not be someone who represents your interests, as if those are kind of static and unchanging. So yeah, I just wanted to give the example of Bolivia to also kind of complement the Zapatista example.
And just a few general comments to wrap things up, perhaps. I think that all the examples that DJs Kayla, Nata, and Profe brought up today really point to a break with the idea of politics as something separate from our daily lives and from the everyday doing of life, and not thinking of politics as something restricted to an institutional space such as the space of the state, the government, or the elections, or the parties, or even classic social movements with a vertical structure, but rather thinking about politics as something that bleeds into to everything that we do every day. And so I think that the actions that we spoke about in the first half of the show, particularly the feminist vigilante march and the kind of anti-patriarchal politics at the root of that, is very relevant for thinking about this, because it's really thinking about the ways that we reproduce forms of power and forms of domination in our everyday relations. And so I encourage everybody to really think about the interconnections and the sort of common threads that run through all of these very dispersed examples that we've been working through today, and try to see how that might resonate with our own experiences here in our local community. So with that, looks like we're going to close out the show for today. This has been Radio Autonomía, Zapatismo in the Bay. We broadcast the first Sunday of every month from 4 to 6 p.m. here on Berkeley Liberation Radio, 104.1 FM, live in the East Bay, and online at berkeleyliberationradio.net. Feel free to shoot us an email at radioautonomia@gmail.com anytime. We'll see you, hear you, and listen with you next month.
If you got the nerve, lash out for your just desserts. It's not just the words. Some of y'all heads up in the cloud. I'ma bring y'all back to earth. It's black back to burn. Bullshit y'all talking about. Out your mouth, I'm not concerned. Cause y'all got to learn. It's y'all turned like Detroit Red. When his head had an ultra perm. The long walk, I burn your bare heels. So throw on your boots. The game camouflage like army suits. But I can see it more clear. Cause I came with the coupe in here. Ring the alarm, inform the troops. Send them out into the world. Go to war on the flute. Eye to eye with the enemy. You sworn to shoot. Now I'm coming at your neck, sick of hearing something wrong with me. Motherfucker, something wrong with you. When the cheek just way too smart to question. The enemy, the brothers of a dark complexion. The governments of the world is shark infested. They have their own weaponry like Sharpton Heston, man. Look, it gets low, man. Low, now I'm talking about. Yeah, that. Yeah.
is my favorite unit. Death to the pigs is my basic statement. I spit street stories till I taste the pavement. Trying to stay out the pen where we face enslavement. Had a foolproof hustle till they traced the payments. I was gripping my palm around some shitty rum. Trying to find Psalm number 151. To forget what I'm owed as I clutch the commodore in. Put down the bottle and come get the gun. Let's get off the chain like Kunta Kinte with a Mac-10. That one was gone like a dollar in a crack den. Steadily subtracting seeds and stems. Mind cloudy through the wheeze and phlegm. Numbing my brain off of that and the Jesus hymns. If we waiting for the time to fight these is them telling us to relax while they ease it in. We're getting greased again. The truth I write is so cold it'll freeze my pen. I boots Riley, it's a pleasure to meet you. Never let they punk ass ever defeat you. They got us on the corner wearing pleather and see-through. All y'all's gold mines, they wanna deplete you. I ain't just finna rap on the track, I'm finna clap on the back. And it's been stacking it act 500 years before Iceberg ever leaned back in the lack. Before they told Rosa Black in the back. Before the CIA told Ricky Ross to put crack in the sack. Then Gil Scott traded rapping for smack. This beat alone should get platinum plaques. I'd rather see a million of us ecstatic to scrap. Cause if we bapping them back, we automatically stack. Check it out.
And see, reboots me, activating the community. Up in the bay like Huey P. They suck a free, it remind me of the BK. There's love for me, but the beast gotta twist it. I'll untangle it. The black mind intertwined like the ropes they used to hang us with. This my favorite shit. I came in the game with a new way to spit. They got your questionnaire, who you banging with? Take it back to M-Hotep. Go a step deeper like a poor righteous teacher with holy intellect. Killer flow for all my real niggas left. But then for the family of the jigaboo that's been a death. Once again, you can feel hip-hop underground. Still about my guap. Gangsta like fuck the cops. Talib Kweli, revolutionary MC. And that ain't about to stop.